Christchurch, New Malden, Sunday the 28th of June 2026, 9:30 service. Nathan Larkin speaking on The Practice of Evangelism by Brian Greene as part of the series Books by Our Forebears.
Okay, so as Stephen said, we're going to be hearing a little bit about another one of our forebears. But as I began to think about this, it got me reflecting on, I don't know if you've ever moved into a house that someone else has lived in for years, and you walk in thinking, this is a blank canvas, an empty house, empty rooms, a fresh start, yours to do whatever you want with. But then you slowly start to notice things. A shelf that's just in the right place, or a plant that comes back every spring. You didn't put it there, but there it is. A cupboard you'd never have designed like that, but somehow it works. And bit by bit, you realize that the previous owners who lived there before, they knew something that you didn't. You're not starting completely from scratch. You're living inside something that someone else has shaped. Their decisions are everywhere, built into the walls, for better and worse. And churches like that. We didn't invent this place, we inherited it. And yes, the way we do things looks very different now than it did 50 or 100 years ago. Different music, different language, different culture. And we might assume that that means that we've sort of started fresh, figured it out for ourselves. But we haven't. The way we pray, the way we think about faith, our instincts about what matters and what doesn't, none of it appeared out of nowhere. It was passed to us by people who sat where you're sitting. This is an old photo of Christchurch here. People who were here 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 150 years ago. It was passed to us by those people who argued and prayed and got things right and got things wrong long before any of us arrived. And different doesn't always mean better. Some of what they knew, we may have quietly lost over the years. Some of the things they practiced, we may have drifted away from without actually ever deciding to. And I think that's one of the brilliant things about doing this series, learning from books that were written by our forebears, is that we don't just get a chance to celebrate what we've inherited, but we get a chance to ask, honestly, what have we been given? What's been passed down that we might have lost? And what was there that we could build on if we were really paying attention? So as Stephen said, I'm going to introduce you to someone who stood almost exactly where I'm standing about 100 years ago. He walked the streets of this parish. He visited people in their homes. He taught. He preached. Lots of things that Stephen or I do in our jobs today. And he was a curate here at Christchurch from 1924 to 1928, so 4 years, not a hugely long time. He was young, relatively unknown, and doing mostly the unglamorous, unseen work of parish ministry. His name was Brian Greene, here he is here. You may not have heard of him, but before he was finished, he became one of the most significant evangelical voices of the 20th century, speaking to tens of thousands across the world, in cathedrals, universities, stadiums, on multiple continents. But, as I said, in 1924, he was just a young curate here in New Malden. And then, after decades of this ministry, traveling the world, speaking to thousands, lots of this hard-won experience, he sat down and he wrote a book, this book. It's called The Practice of Evangelism. And this morning, we're going to look at what he said and ask what, if anything, it might say to us today. So to understand what he wrote, it helps to know how Brian Greene got there. And so here's a little bit about him. His own coming to faith, he describes as quiet, not dramatic, no lightning bolt, more like a slow realization. Something happened, he would say, but nothing spectacular. A turning and a trust. And it came with that, when he chose to follow Jesus, he had this immediate desire to help other people find that same thing, which led to him becoming ordained, and then in 1924, him arriving here in the parish. He was young, 23 at the time, energetic, and by his own admission, occasionally a bit too enthusiastic. And those 4 years in New Malden were, again in his own words, not very dramatic. But something happens here that I think tells you an awful lot about who Brian Greene was. Because he, as part of his job, really wanted to start a children's group. And at that time, there was an obvious ready-made option if you were a clergyman wanting to start a children's group in your parish. It was called Crusaders. I think it still exists today as Urban Saints. And they were well-established, well-respected. The sensible choice for a curate who wanted to hit the ground running, an easy thing to plug into, and it saved in reinventing the wheel. But at that time, Crusaders was for boys only. And Brian Greene said, no, that's not good enough. And he walked away from the easy option and instead built something from scratch because he wanted everyone to be included. It was called King's Own, and it was open to boys and girls. And in a 1920s church, that was something that really cost him. It would have cost him convenience. It would have cost him probably goodwill from some people who didn't see why he would have to make things complicated. But I think it tells you something really important about him. Because before he ever wrote a word about evangelism, before the crowds and the cathedrals and the 100 transatlantic flights, he was someone who looked into a room and said, who's missing? He cared instinctively about who had access to that invitation. And he wasn't interested in evangelism just for some people. He wanted it for everyone, even the girls. And the amazing thing about what he built, King's Own, was that it outlasted him by decades. He was here for 4 years, but the thing he built kept running long after he left, well into the mid-70s, when it was eventually replaced by Cypher, and it impacted hundreds and hundreds of people's lives. I think that's worth sitting with for a moment, because sometimes it's the small, ordinary things, a decision, a group formed a certain way, a refusal to accept an unnecessary exclusion, standing up for something that you believe is right, even when it makes your life a bit harder. Those little moments can turn out to be shaping something far, far bigger than anyone at the time would realize. So you never know what you're starting when you feel that you need to do something that's right. And that's maybe something that can give us a bit of encouragement this morning. But from New Malden, things expanded in his life and in his ministry in ways that would have been hard to predict from those quiet curate years here. He went on to serve at Holy Trinity Brompton, HTB, and then later at St. Martin in the Bullring in Birmingham, where on his first Sunday, by this stage he's a bit older and had been ministering for quite a few years, but on his first Sunday, word of his arrival got out and the congregation went from about 100 to over 1,000. He became known as an evangelist of extraordinary range, someone who could speak to students and to dockers, to cathedral congregations and university missions with the same conviction and warmth. He crossed the Atlantic over 100 times and spoke on 5 continents. He had a friendship with Billy Graham, who knew a thing or two about this, and he said that probably no foreign evangelist had more influence on America in his time than Brian Greene. In fact, he was called by some the Anglican Billy Graham and England's finest evangelist. And yet, the thing that kept striking me as I was reading his book is he never stopped insisting that the real work was local. He was involved in these massive missions, but he thought that ministry was most vital when it was rooted in the ordinary parish, the ordinary Christians living ordinary lives. Those big missions were a tool, but the parish was the soil. And then in 1951, after decades of all of that, he sat down and he wrote it all out. And the practice of evangelism, it's not a theoretical book. It wasn't written by someone who'd studied evangelism from a distance and devised a system of words to tell people about Jesus. It's written by someone who'd spent 30 years doing it and wanted to pass on what he'd learned. So what did he say? Well, before I say what he said, I have a bit of a confession to make, because I think for a lot of us, maybe even some of us in the room, Evangelism can be a bit of a loaded word, maybe even a dirty word. Sometimes we think, oh, because when we hear it, we don't think of someone gently sharing something that really matters to them. We have memories or thoughts of the pushy stranger on the high street with a megaphone, the TV preacher promising that you'll have an easy life if you accept Jesus, and of course send some money to the preacher, or the door knockers handing out tracts about how sinful you are, trusting that this shame would somehow lead you to God. The sense of being maneuvered into a decision that you didn't ask to make. And if that's the association at all you have with that word, evangelism, then the embarrassment makes sense. A lot of Christians are embarrassed by how evangelism has been done in the past, and sometimes still is now. So when I picked up a book, and here's my confession, written in 1951, called The Practice of Evangelism, I'll be honest, I had already decided what I was pretty sure I was going to find. I expected a lot of that older model, heavy on, you know, hitting people with a message that they needed to make about deciding for Jesus, light on relationships, missing love, probably. The kind where someone, you know, corners you after a meeting and asks if you've accepted Christ into your heart, and you're not quite sure what that means, but you feel you probably should. I expected to find it interesting in a historical way, and then to explain to you why we do things much better than that now. But I was going to be generous about it, of course. You know, charitable, he was a product of his time, remarkable for the era, you know, that kind of thing. But then I actually read it, and I had to sit with something that C.S. Lewis once called chronological snobbery. And I suffer from this, no doubt, because it's that quiet assumption that older means less wise, that the direction of travel is always progress, that we know better than they did in the past, and that we have naturally arrived at the better understanding. Because what I found in reading Brian Greene was not a man that I'd outgrown. I found someone who cared deeply about people, who prayed for people regularly, praying for them by name, not vaguely, but specifically with real people in mind, who had a concern and a love for the people he ministered to. He actually warns against that anxious evangelism that tips into manipulation, who says things like coming to faith is usually gradual, not dramatic, who insisted that before you share anything of your faith, you should genuinely care about the person, really care, not as a project, but as a person. In fact, in his words, the proper posture, he wrote, is a deep and open concern for the lives of those among whom we live, which is something very different, he says, from proselytizing, the pushy, agenda-driven version that makes people cross the street. This concern that he describes is real and costly, but not anxious or controlling. Because ultimately, he's really keen to point out, this is not our work anyway. We're joining something that God is already doing. Now, that's not what I expected to find. In fact, in many ways, that sounds quite a lot more like we aim to be today. And as I said before, the moment that we hear these words, like giving people a chance to make a decision or a response, when we hear that, sometimes we do hear those alarm bells, and perhaps that's understandable. Perhaps we have seen or heard stories of that version that went badly wrong, where emotion was deliberately stirred up to get a reaction, where the atmosphere made it harder to say no than yes, where people walked away having made a commitment they didn't really understand and felt manipulated rather than invited, where sharing faith became less about love and more about closing a deal. And it is real, and we shouldn't pretend that these things haven't happened and Christians haven't behaved in these ways, and it has often done real damage. But being wary of that isn't a weakness, it's wisdom. But here's the thing, rejecting putting pressure on people shouldn't be the same as avoiding offering a genuine invitation to follow Jesus. The answer to manipulation isn't silence. And I think that's something I've really appreciated through reading this. Because if we look at the story, the journey of evangelism in this country over the last 100 years, you can see a movement. There were seasons, particularly in the 19th and early 20th centuries, when these large missions, big gatherings, dramatic calls to respond were the main currency. Huge events, public moments, clear, sometimes intense invitations to decide for Jesus then or there and then. And I don't want to criticize that. Many amazing stories came out of those ministries. And yeah, that was how it was done. But partly because of some of the critiques I've already mentioned, over time it became growing and sort of largely justified discomfort with something that seemed coercive or manipulative, and churches began to emphasize relationship, trust, the idea that faith is a long journey rather than a single moment, meeting people where they are rather than pressing them forward towards where you want them to be. And more recently, in churches a lot like ours, we've really leaned further into that welcome and belonging, creating space for people to explore at their own pace without too much pressure. The idea that you can belong here before you believe everything that other people believe, and that community comes first. And in most ways, that's been a really good development. But I wonder, and I'm asking this of myself as much as anyone, whether in learning to walk alongside people so well, we've become less sure how to help them take the next step. Whether in our entirely understandable desire not to pressure people, not to shame or exclude, we've become so gentle that we're not really offering an invitation to follow Jesus at all. You see, this is what Brian Greene is really, really helpful on. More helpful than I expected. Because for all that careful, patient, person-first concern, the part that sounds so much like what we hold to, he holds on to something that we might have become less confident about. He believes that in that journey, somewhere in that long relational journey, there comes a moment, a point where someone moves from circling around faith to stepping into it. From, I find this quite interesting, to I trust that this is true. From considering Jesus to following him. And he describes it simply, not again a dramatic experience, but a quiet turning. Something like, Lord, I'm like this, help me to find you. That's it, no performance, no pressure, a real personal response to a real invitation. And he believed that moment really mattered. That helping someone reach that moment, not pushing them, but not leaving them guessing either, was one of the most loving things that we could do. And looking at those two passages that we read this morning, they say something really important about all of this. In Isaiah 55, we read, come all who are thirsty, come to the waters. All you who have no money, come and buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. And then later, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he's near. Jesus makes it even more explicit in John 10. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Now, if we just take that tone in for a moment, this isn't a God who's reluctant or hard to reach or waiting to catch us out and to tell us off. This is a God who's leaning towards us, leaning forward, saying, whatever you're carrying, whatever state you're in, whatever you think disqualifies you, come. I'm here, I'm waiting. No price, no barrier, no shame, just an open, extravagant, almost embarrassingly generous invitation. But, and this matters, it's not vague. It's not, you know, come and wander in the general direction of something spiritual and see how it makes you feel. It's not, pop along on a Sunday to church for a little while and see if it cheers you up. Look at Isaiah's verbs, come, seek, call, active words. They ask something of us. Now, the offer is completely free, but a gift still has to be picked up. And Jesus, again, makes it sharper. He's not offering principles to improve our life or a community just to belong to or ideas to explore. He's offering, in his own words, life, real life to the full, the kind human beings were made for. That's an extraordinary claim and an exclusive one, which sometimes doesn't sit very comfortably with modern instincts that want all paths to be equally valid. But Jesus says, this is the way to life. I am it. And Christianity stands or falls on that. Either it's true or it isn't. But if it is, which I believe it is, if he really is the way into life and to life in the full, then sharing it isn't an imposition. As Brian Greene wrote about, it's the most loving thing that we can do. A gate stands open. No one should be pushed through it. But at some point, you do have to step through it. So, in reading Brian Greene, I've had to ask that hard question of myself and perhaps about us as a church. not about the care. I hope we do that fairly well. There's always room to grow and we may get things wrong. But hopefully this is a church that's good at welcome and warmth, at walking with people through the things that they're dealing with in tough lives, at making space for the questions that people have without anyone feeling judged for asking. And I want to hold on to all of that. But that other part that Green wouldn't let go of, are we confident enough in what Jesus offers? Confident that it really is full life, that thing people are searching for? Are we confident enough to help someone take a step forward when that moment comes? Not to push or pressure, but to be brave enough to say, I think you might be ready. I think this is the thing that will make things make sense to you. The door is right there. You don't have to stay outside. Because the thing is, you can walk alongside someone for years, genuinely caring for them. But we need to recognize when someone is close. We can walk alongside them and never give them the one thing that they actually need. Someone to say clearly, this is real and this is for you, and you can know him. And in that moment when it is close, I think the loving thing isn't to back away out of politeness or embarrassment, but to gently, clearly invite them to take that step. And that takes courage, but it takes paying attention. It takes actually believing that what's on the other side of that door is worth stepping through for. So here's what I want to say in closing to those of us who do follow Jesus. Let's follow Brian Green's example. Pray for people that we care about, not vaguely, specifically. That person that you've been meaning to invite somewhere, that friend who keeps asking questions, the family member who started coming to church but hasn't quite decided what they think of it. Pray for them, care for them, walk with them. But when that moment comes, when you sense that they're close, when the question is live, and when the door is visible, don't leave them standing outside it alone. We're not trying to grow the membership of a club or recruit people to our tribe because, hey, it's nice to have some more bodies in the room on a Sunday. We just really believe that when Jesus says he is the way to full life, he's telling the truth. And the kindest thing we can do is to share that. Be brave enough to name it and gentle enough not to force it. And if you are here this morning and faith is something you're still circling, still exploring, still have lots of questions, not sure what you think, then let me speak directly to you. You are genuinely welcome here. That's not a line that we say to trick people. Your questions are taken seriously, and you don't have to pretend to believe things you don't. You can take all the time you need. But I also don't want to leave you thinking that it doesn't matter whether you ever respond, because it does. Not to us, we're not keeping score, to you. Jesus isn't offering a philosophy to consider, or a community to test out, or a set of ideas to weigh up indefinitely. He is offering life to the full. The kind Isaiah describes, where the thirsty actually get to drink, where what you've been searching for turns out to be freely available, where you don't have to keep standing outside wondering what's on the other side. That offer has your name on it, and at some point it becomes something you can step into. Not with everything figured out or with every doubt resolved, just with trust. A quiet turning towards the God who's been leaning towards you all along. So if you're there, or even close, don't drift past it. Take that step. And one day, maybe in another 100 years' time, someone else will stand where I'm standing, and they'll look back at us the way that we've looked back at Brian Green and some of these others in the last few weeks, and they'll ask the same questions. What did we believe? What did we do with it? Did they take it seriously enough to pass it on? Brian Green started here 4 years, that was all, as a young curate in an ordinary parish doing mostly invisible work, making a decision about a youth group that turned out to matter for decades. And from here, something grew that shaped thousands of lives across the world. He wasn't perfect, and in many ways, I'm sure he was a man of his time, but he held on to something that we need to hold on to as well. The conviction that the gospel, the good news about Jesus, is genuinely good news, worth sharing, worth the awkwardness and the courage and the long, patient work of relationship. He didn't offer us a method in this book to copy or a program that we should run, but he challenged us to recover a posture, a deep and open concern for the lives of those around us. So walk with people, pray for them, care for them, pay attention to where God is already at work in their lives. And when that moment comes, be brave enough not to miss it. Because love walks with people, but love also tells the truth about the next step. And may we be a church that does both.